Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really big one. We're cutting through the dense language of House Bill No. 8002, the Act Concerning Housing Growth.
Yeah, and this isn't just a small tweak. We're talking about a massive overhaul.
Right. It feels like a state-level declaration that, the old way of doing local zoning is basically over. It touches everything from how you save for a house to mandatory density rules for towns.
That's a perfect way to put it. This act is, it's hundreds of pages long. It's all these interconnected incentives, deadlines, and penalties.
A real web.
It is. The state is trying to solve the housing crisis by tying a town's cooperation directly to getting crucial state money for things like infrastructure, for schools.
So our mission today is to break all that down. We want you to walk away with a really clear picture of the new rules of the game for housing for the next, what, decade?
At least.
Okay, so where do we even start? Let's begin with the carrot. The thing the state is offering the individual buyer, this is the new first-time homebuyer savings account, the FHSA.
Right, and that kicks in on January 1st, 2026. You should think of it as a sparalyzed, tax-advantaged account, almost like a 401k, but only for your down payment.
Highly targeted then.
Extremely. The money in an FHSA is designated only for what they call eligible costs,
Which are?
your down payment and any allowable closing costs. And it has to be for a primary residence, a 1-to-4 family home, and you, the account holder, have to be a first-time home buyer.
Okay, so pretty strict. How flexible are these accounts mechanically? Like, what can you put the money in?
Well, they're very restricted there, too. It has to be
Right.
cash, and you can only invest it in money market funds.
So they're prioritizing stability, not some high-risk growth strategy.
Exactly. They don't want you gambling with a down payment. But, and this is important, there's no limit on how much you can contribute in total over the years.
Now, here's the part that really jumped out at me, the employer component.
Yes. The bill explicitly allows employers to contribute to these accounts.
Which is a huge tool for attracting talent. But what happens if that employee leaves? Does the company get to claw that money back?
And here's where it gets really interesting and surprisingly generous. The act says no. If the account holder leaves that job, the employer cannot get their contribution back.
Wow. So it's a permanent gift.
It's a permanent, non-recoverable gift to encourage homeownership for their workers. It's a big deal.
Okay, that definitely boosts the value.
Yeah.
Let's talk hard numbers, though. The real carrot is the tax benefit, right? Which starts a year later in 2027.
That's the core of it, yeah. But it's also tightly income restricted. This is really aimed at the middle and upper middle class.
What are the limits?
You have to meet the federal adjusted gross income limits. So that's $125,000 for single filers or heads of household and $250,000 for joint filers.
And if you're under those caps, what can you actually subtract from your gross income?
You get three separate subtractions. First, your contributions up to a cap. It's $2,500 a year for singles and $5,000 for joint filers. Second, you can subtract the sum of all the interest the account earns that year.
All of it.
All of it. And then finally, when you actually pull the money out for your down payment, that withdrawal amount is also subtracted from your gross income.
So it's truly tax-free savings for a house. But,
Yeah.
I mean, let's be realistic. With current prices, is $5,000 a year really enough to move the needle for someone trying to buy a starter home?
It's not a silver bullet, no, but it's a subsidized path to a down payment. If you're a couple and you max out that $5,000 deduction for 5 years, that's $25,000 you've sheltered from state tax, plus all the interest.
It helps bridge that gap, I guess.
It helps bridge the gap, especially for dual income families right near those income ceilings. It's a genuine shortcut.
And like with any tax benefit, I assume there's a penalty if you misuse it.
Oh, absolutely. There's a firm penalty. It's a 10% civil penalty if you withdraw the funds for anything other than those eligible costs.
So no using it for a new car.
Definitely not. They want this money in housing. Of course, the standard exceptions apply for things like death, disability, or bankruptcy.
Okay, so we've seen the carrot for the buyer, but the real structural change here, the real shift, relies on local governments. Let's talk about the stick, the mandatory planning requirement.
This is a huge piece of it, and it kicks in at the start of 2026. The state is essentially demanding that every single municipality create a serious coordinated housing plan.
And they have two options, right?
Two options. Either prepare and adopt their own municipal housing growth plan, an MHGP, or they can choose to comply with a regional housing growth plan.
And doing nothing is not an option.
Not an option. And the deadlines are coming up fast. We're talking June 2028 or June 2029, depending on where you are in the state.
And these plans, they're not just, wish lists. They require some really deep analysis.
They're detailed blueprints. A key part is creating an inventory of what the law calls developable land.
And they get very specific about what that means.
Very specific. It excludes public land, dedicated open space, wetlands, and, you know, big steep slopes that you can't build on anyway.
The plans also have to identify specific zones or parcels for development that can be approved through a summary review process. What does summary review actually mean in practice?
Summary review is the tool designed to cut through the red tape. It means for those specific parcels, a development can move forward without a public hearing, without a special permit, and without a variance.
So it basically bypasses the main avenues for local opposition, for NBism.
That's exactly what it's designed to do. It prioritizes speed and predictability over local debate on projects that already fit the approved plan.
A huge regulatory hurdle just gone. What else do these plans need to cover?
They have to promote diverse housing types. So not just single-family homes, but different sizes, bedroom counts, densities. They also have to address accessibility for people with developmental disabilities and, importantly, project their infrastructure needs.
Like wastewater capacity.
Exactly. You can't plan for more houses if you don't have the sewer capacity to support them.
So who sets the actual targets, the numbers these towns have to hit?
That comes from the top. The Office of Policy and Management, or OPM. Every 10 years, OPM sets the state and regional housing goals. Then the regional councils of governments, the RCOGs, they take those numbers and assign a recommended affordable housing goal to each town.
And the way they assign those goals, the methodology, that's where the state is really linking wealth to responsibility.
Precisely. The methodology is designed to do exactly that. It has to consider fair housing, and it looks at things like housing cost burden and overcrowding. But, crucially, a town's goal goes up if it has a higher median income or a higher equalized net grand list per capita.
Okay, that's a very technical term. For our listeners, what does that metric actually measure?
It's basically the state's way of measuring a town's wealth. It's the tax base relative to its population. So by tying the goal to that metric, the state is saying in black and white, the richer your town, the stronger your tax base, the bigger your housing obligation is.
A direct link. Is there any kind of cap on these goals?
Yes, there's a hard cap. No recommended goal can be more than 20% of the occupied homes that are already in the town.
This is a lot of planning. But what's a real leverage? What stops a town from just dragging its feet or submitting a weak plan?
The leverage is all financial, and it's powerful. If you want money from the new housing growth program, and this is for essential infrastructure grants for water lines, sewers, your eligibility is tied directly to making progress on your housing plan.
So if you want state money for your town's needs,
you have to play ball on housing.
And there's a penalty too?
A big one. If a town fails to submit an approved plan, they can lose their eligibility for the Affordable Housing Appeals Moratorium, which means they lose their main protection against developers who want to challenge them for blocking multifamily housing.
Okay, let's move to the zoning changes, the things that will physically change how some neighborhoods look. The bill creates priority housing development zones, or PHDZs.
Right. These are meant to be high-impact overlay zones. They have to cover at least 10% of a town's developable land. And the really revolutionary part is that in these zones, you must permit multifamily housing as of right.
And that phrase, as of right, is so critical here. It just means speed. No long discretionary approval process, just making sure the site plan checks out.
Exactly. And to make sure these zones actually produce housing, the state set mandatory minimum densities.
Not suggestions.
No, these are requirements. Per acre, it's a minimum of 4 units for single-family homes, 6 for a duplex or townhouse, and 10 units in multifamily.
And to hit that 10 unit per acre mark, towns are basically sourced to be flexible.
They have to be. The law gives local zoning commissions the power to change, waive, or even get rid of their own dimensional standards. Things like height limits, setbacks, parking ratios, if that's what it takes to hit the density target.
That's a profound shift. It puts the state's density goals above a town's local aesthetic rules.
It absolutely does. It forces them to adapt.
And this zoning revolution is also tied directly to transit. It creates something called a qualifying transit-oriented community, a QTOC.
Yes, a QTOC is a town with a rapid transit or a regular bus station. And that bus has to run at least 5 days a week, every hour during peak times, inside a designated transit-oriented district, a TOD.
And if you're a QTOC, you get access to that critical housing grant money.
That's the incentive.
So what kind of development do these towns have to allow as of right in those districts.
Three main types, all without a special permit or public hearing, unless there are wetlands involved. First is what the bill calls transit community middle housing. That's 2 to 9 units.
So townhouses, duplexes.
Exactly, or things like the perfect sixes.
I love that term. It's such a great way to describe a simple, low-rise building that can add density without, you know, a giant tower.
It is. The second mandate is for developments of 10 or more units, if at least 30% of them are set aside as affordable. And third, any project on land owned by the town, a housing authority, or a nonprofit is as of right, as long as all the units are deed restricted for low-income tenants for 40 years.
And for a big market rate project that isn't automatically as of right, there's a new inclusionary zoning rule.
That's right. For projects of 10 or more units not covered by those exemptions, you have to set aside units as affordable. It's 5% in low opportunity markets, but it jumps to 10% in municipalities that are designated as high opportunity or heating markets.
So it makes it more expensive to build market rate housing in wealthy, high demand areas, unless you include affordability.
That's the goal.
Which brings us to Section 3. And this one, I think this is where a lot of residents will see the most immediate changes, starting with parking.
This is what I'd call the parking revolution, and it's effective July 1st, 2026. What's so disruptive is that it creates a near total ban on towns requiring a minimum number of parking spaces for residential development.
So decades of these costly mandates that force developers to build seas of asphalt, they're just gone.
For the most part, yes. The developer and the market get to decide how much parking is needed, not the town planner.
But there are a few exceptions.
A few, but they're structured to give the developer all the leverage. For projects over 16 units, a town can ask for a minimum, but it's immediately capped. It can't be more than the standard density, one space for a one-bedroom, two for a two-bedroom, or, and this is the key, the recommendation of a parking needs assessment that the developer pays for.
So if the town's rule says you need 50 spots, but the developer study shows that, based on transit access, you only need 30.
The developer wins. The requirement is capped at 30. The power shifts completely to the data.
And what if a town wants parking, but they'd rather have it in a shared municipal garage instead of on every single property?
The bill formalizes the fee in lieu option. A developer can pay a fee instead of building parking spaces. But the crucial part is that money has to be segregated and used only for municipal parking, traffic, or transit projects.
It can't just go into the general fund.
Nope. It's earmarked.
Okay, let's pivot to social housing and tenant protections. The bill expands those pretty significantly.
It does, starting in early 2026. The first is a ban on what's called hostile architecture.
So we're talking about things designed to keep homeless people from resting in public spaces.
Yeah.
Like the armrests they put in the middle of park benches.
Exactly like that. Or concrete spikes under bridges. The law prohibits towns from installing those on publicly accessible property. And if they get a written complaint about a new structure, they have to investigate and remove it.
The burden is on the town.
Entirely. We also see a major expansion of fair rent commissions.
Right. The population threshold changed.
It dropped significantly. It used to be towns with 25,000 people or more. Now that threshold is just 15,000.
So that pulls in a whole lot of smaller, often wealthier, suburban towns into this regulatory system. They now have to create a body that can investigate things like excessive rent hikes.
Exactly. It extends that tenant protection framework into places that have had very little oversight before.
And there's also a short-term pilot program for the most vulnerable renters.
Yes, a temporary direct rental assistance program. It's designed to give cash payments for rent directly to people who are stuck on the waiting list for a federal housing choice voucher. It's a stopgap measure.
Okay, and finally, there are two very specific reforms for tenants.
Yeah, two quick but important ones. First, if a landlord's online payment system is broken and stops the tenant from paying on time, the landlord can't start an eviction. The grace period automatically gets extended by 5 days.
A modern solution for a modern problem.
And second, a key safety change. Elevators in private multifamily buildings now have to be inspected every 12 months, not every 18 months, just more frequent safety checks.
So if we step back and try to synthesize all of this, House Bill 8002 is this unified assault on the housing crisis. It coordinates the economic incentives like the FHSA with the mandatory local planning and then forces these market disrupting zoning changes.
Like killing parking minimums and creating as of right density near transit.
Yeah.
And I think the genius of the bill, or maybe the ruthlessness of it, is how it's all connected back to money. The state is saying, you want infrastructure grants. You want higher reimbursement rates for your school construction projects. Then you have to show us real, measurable progress on your housing goals.
It's a definitive shift. Local zoning control is no longer absolute. The state is using its financial power to enforce housing production across every town, rich or poor.
Which I think raises a really important question for you, the listener. The state has made its intent clear. It has removed local veto power over density and gotten rid of these costly parking requirements. So given that this link between a town's housing policy and its access to vital state funding is now so strong, how quickly will we see this actually translate into building permits, into a measurable increase in diverse housing options, especially in the towns that have historically been the most resistant to growth?
That measurable outcome is what we will all be watching very closely. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into House Bill 8002.